All honor to you who are mothers, stepmothers, caregivers, and let's include everyone who graciously supports mothers and those who nurture children or pets or plants as a loving mother might. But I know that days like this can be unhappy too. They may remind us of something we don't have, never had, or don't have anymore. Mothers may be grieving for lost children, separated children, or children they never had. Grown children may be grieving for their mothers or remembering ways in which their mothers harmed them. So my heart is open to you, knowing that today may be complicated. There are two famous mothers in Buddhism that we can honor today. There is Maya, Buddha's mother, who tradition tells us died 7 days after Buddha was born. In Buddhist mythology, however, after her death, Maya incarnated in a heaven realm and continued to have contact with her son there. Maya is also one of the spiritual benefactors that the pilgrim Sudana visits on his journey in search of enlightenment in the final book of the Avatamsaka Flower Ornament Sutra. The other mother is Mahapajapati, Buddha's stepmother and maternal aunt, who raised him along with her other children while she was married to Buddha's father, King Suddhodana. Later, after the king died, Mahapajapati went to the Buddha and requested ordination, but he was not in favor of women joining the Sangha. Finally, though, through the intervention of his cousin Ananda, the Buddha established the order of nuns and ordained Mahapajapati as its founder. In Tibetan Buddhism, there is a teaching that all beings have been our mothers at one point in the cycle of birth. Therefore, we can look upon everyone as our mother and express kindness, respect, and gratitude to them. There's also the inverse of that teaching. We can look upon all beings as if they are our own children. The Metta Sutta says, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Anyway, as today is Mother's Day, knowing that, anticipating that, it seemed a good opportunity for me to study some ways that the role of mother shows up in the teachings that we draw on in Zen. And I'm not sure if this is partly a research report or a Dharma talk, but there's some things that I wanted to think about. And so here we are. And the title of my talk today is Three Spiritual Mothers: Mystic, Primal, Inner. From India, we have the mystic mother, Mahaprajna Paramita. Buddha's mother, Maya, was named in the Hindu tradition, where Maya is the creative principle that creates a universe of multiple forms, which then conceal the inherent unity of absolute being. So they conceal that. And I think that's a pretty odd name for a baby girl. There's probably a story that we don't know about that. In Buddhism, the veil of Maya similarly represents ignorance, avijja, that obscures our essential nature and creates the subject-object delusion that I exist here and everything else is out there separate from me. Unveiling, then, is an event that takes over one's usual ego-based, self-centered perception and displays life in a way that changes your understanding of how things are. Spiritual insight, that's the source of wisdom, prajna. Prajna paramita is the perfect or the transcendent wisdom that completely frees our minds from the delusion of separateness. It reveals the original nature of life to be a boundless expanse of openness and transparency. Robert Thurman says that the bodhisattva who encounters perfect wisdom feels the great relief of freedom from subjective and objective self habits with joy and gratitude that knows no bounds. That experience is often spoken of as birth, the start of a new life. This is the perfect wisdom that's the subject of the vast writings of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, including the Heart Sutra that we chant so often. The Prajnaparamita Sutras generally express the emptiness teaching of Mahayana Buddhism, which emerged in India beginning about 400 years after the Buddha's lifetime. In his book, Mother of the Buddhas, Meditation on the Prajnaparamita Sutra, Les Hickson suggests that Mahayana arose from reimagining Buddhism as more than a monastic or individual practice for renunciates. It developed as a social gospel of love and compassion based on an understanding of emptiness as the truth that all things lacked a fixed identity. Lacking an unchanging essence didn't mean that things didn't exist. It meant that their existence was thoroughly relative. And because all beings are relative, there is no limit to their being creatively reshaped by enlightened love. The Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines. And that's the book that Les Hickson was speaking of in the book title I just gave you. It appeared around 100 BCE and is considered the originating text of Mahayana. It describes the mind of a mature practitioner of Mahayana like this. The bodhisattva will always maintain a motherly mind, consecrated to the constant protection, education, and maturing of conscious beings, inviting and guiding them along the path of all-embracing love. It's quite a job description. Buddhas are figuratively born from the transcendent experience of realizing Prajnaparamita. So it follows that given that they are born, the perfection of wisdom is their mother. That's how the perfection of transcendent wisdom came to be known as the mother of all Buddhas. Next came personifying it as the goddess Prajnaparamita, who is also known as the mother of Buddhas. She is the ideal mother who observes all sentient beings without making distinctions, protects them, and supports them equally with love and compassion. And since she gives birth to new life, bodhisattvas seek to be changed by her and receive a new enlightened life from her. The tone of the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines is of an exuberant celebration and gratitude for this mother's help and support. I thought you might enjoy a taste of this mother of Buddha's. So I'm going to read my abridged version of the mystic hymn to the Wisdom Mother from Hickson's book. And this is a conversation mostly by Shariputra. So Shariputra starts, he's speaking to Buddha. This perfection of wisdom, O radiant Lord, is none other than the total awakenedness, which is omniscience. Lord Buddha says, so it is, noble Shariputra, precisely as you say. Shariputra says, the perfection of wisdom shines forth as a sublime light, O Buddha nature. I sing this spontaneous hymn of lights to praise Mother Prajnaparamita. She is an ever-flowing fountain of incomparable light. She leads living beings into her clear light from the blindness and obscurity caused by partial and distorted views of reality. In her alone can we find true refuge. She dissipates entirely the mental gloom of delusion. Mother Prajnaparamita is total awakenedness. She is known as the Great Mother by those spiritually mature beings who dedicate their mind streams to the liberation and full enlightenment of all lives. She is not marked by fundamental characteristics. This absence of characteristics is her transcendent, mystic motherhood, the radiant blackness of her womb. She is the universal benefactress who presents the miraculous gem which generates the power of a Buddha to elevate living beings into the consciousness of their innate Buddha nature. She is the clear knowledge of the open and transparent mode of being shared by all relative structures and events. She is the perfect wisdom who gives birthless birth to all Buddhas. And through these sublimely awakened ones, it is Mother Prajnaparamita alone who turns the wheel of true teaching. And Lord Buddha says, precisely so, beloved Shariputra. So references to wombs and birthless births take us to another book that I read. And it's a book by Red Pine called The Heart Sutra, The Womb of Buddhas. Red Pine is a noted translator of important Buddhist sutras, and this book is very widely read. As you are familiar with, The Heart Sutra is a short perfection of wisdom sutra that has something unusual at the end of it. Unusual in the sense that it's not common for a perfection of wisdom sutra to have a mantra. Some people analyze the words of the mantra, gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhisva, and they see in the words a succinct expression of the entire meaning of the Heart Sutra. And others see it as a magically protective invocation. Red Pine's point of view is that the function of this mantra is to go beyond language and the categorization in which language imprisons us He says, mantras are the creation of beings in touch with the underlying vibrations of the mind and the sounds that unlock its power through sympathetic harmonics. He says that a mantra is like a magic lamp, which itself is often cast in the shape of a womb. If you rub it correctly, its resident genie will appear. Resident genie of this mantra is Prajnaparamita, the goddess of wisdom. But instead of bringing forth a genie, as other mantras are intended to do, this mantra draws us inside where we become the genie. Chanting this mantra thus creates the womb from which we are reborn as Buddhas. Red Pine suggests that the teaching of Prajnaparamita has long been known as the mother of Buddhas because Buddhas become Buddhas as a result of their ability to penetrate and be transformed by this teaching. The Heart Sutra must then be Prajnaparamita's womb, with our conception and subsequent birth as Buddhas made possible by the mantra at the end of the sutra. So this is Red Pine's take on the Heart Sutra. And I wonder what you think of it. For me, the aspiration to know and live life with wisdom put me on a spiritual path. I came to Buddhism when I was pregnant with my first child, and with the deep acknowledgement that I needed to be a better person to be the mother of my child. I had a kind of out-of-body experience immediately after his birth, which became part of my experience of motherhood, although I didn't understand it. I find, in general, wisdom teachings on openness and transparency, non-separateness, relief from delusion, and all-embracing love very meaningful and inspiring. And I will always enjoy the words and the vibrational effect of chanting the Heart Sutra. But overall, this metaphor of mystic motherhood does not feel relevant to me as a woman. Though I'd like to hear if you have any thoughts about that. But anyway, onward to China, where I feel much more at home. One of the best books I read last year was a book by David Hinton, China Root, Taoism, Chan, and Original Zen. Tim Burkett is currently leading a study group on this really fascinating book. So I'm going to say something about this book in a nutshell. It's a little bit hard for me to do this, but if you object to it later, you can correct me. Hinton examines the way Taoist ontology, so ontology is the study of the nature of being, and Taoist cosmology, and that's the origin and development of the universe. So these are things in Buddhism we talk about a lot, ontology and cosmology. And I have to confess that many times when I see these words, I forget what they mean and I have to look them up, but they show up over and over again. And they provide a conceptual framework that shapes them. And I agree with that because from having edited Katagiri Roshi's teachings, a lot of what I read in this book echoes directly what Katagiri Roshi was teaching in different words in general. So Tao is the central concept of Taoism, first recorded in the I Ching, sometime before 1000 BCE, and poetically expressed by the great Taoist sage Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching in about the 6th century BCE. Taoism derives from a primal, gynocentric oral wisdom tradition going back to China's Paleolithic cultures, where the empirical cosmos was recognized as female in its fundamental nature, a perpetually generative organism in constant transformation. You're probably familiar, many of you I'm sure are familiar with the Tao Te Ching, but I thought I'd just read the first chapter for this occasion. The Tao that can be described is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be spoken is not the eternal name. The nameless is the boundary of heaven and earth. The named is the mother of creation. Freed from desire, you can see the hidden mystery. By having desire, you can only see what is visibly real. Yet mystery and reality emerge from the same source. This source is called darkness, darkness born of darkness, the beginning of all understanding. So you can see Taoism using female images, such as the mother of creation or mother of all things, to represent the generative nature of Tao, the way that is otherwise unnameable. Hinton says that Lao Tzu uses the term Tao to describe the cosmos or universe as a single living tissue, a gossamer presence that is barely there and yet inexplicably generative in its very nature. Tao is not a thing, but the source of a process that produces the material cosmos, a pathway by which things come into existence, evolve through their lives, and then go out of existence, only to be transformed and reemerge in a new form. And this is what we know as the Buddha way. Tao is present in the deepest and unnameable level of being, where the distinction between absence and presence arises. Absence is the empirical cosmos seen as a single generative tissue, a formless void from which this ever-changing realm of presence perpetually emerges. There is no metaphysical womb here from which things emerge. The tissue itself becomes things through the working of Tao. I think that statement, the tissue itself becomes things through the working of Tao, is something that you can kind of hang your hat on to try to understand how this process is working. Presence is the cosmos seen as that single generative tissue, lively and in motion, shaping itself into the individual forms that we see, following inner patterns of intentionality, desire, or intelligence that we might call universal mind, Buddha mind, or one mind. Those patterns shape the chi energy pulsing through the cosmos as the forces of yin and yang, according to what we might call interdependent co-origination. Life is constantly burgeoning forth and shaping itself into the material world. So going back to the Heart Sutra, absence is virtually synonymous with emptiness if we understand emptiness as the absence of particular forms, as in no thingness or formlessness. Then absence is emptiness and presence is form. Absence is all existence seen as one undifferentiated tissue, and presence is that same tissue seen in its differentiated forms. As I understand it, absence is what Prajnaparamita shows us when our subject-object-based mind is quiet. Then, from a foundation of seeing absence, seeing presence is seeing the world emerging around us with truly open eyes, which are a Buddha's eyes. Each moment and each thing is an origin moment slash place. That's how Hinton describes it. What Buddhism talks about as the present moment of life that is occurring at the intersection of time and space. In terms of Zen practice, we are learning to be present and aware of ourselves as existing within this dynamic process so that we can live our lives as they truly are. In our ordinary human understanding, we are separate from everything else. Zen practice restores us to belonging to the whole process, where we are being created by the primal mother of the cosmos. And when we become intimately aware of being within that whole, there's bliss. This whole representation of Tao as a mother feels wonderfully supportive to me. I feel I can depend on this mother. And here's something from Katagiri Roshi. Buddhist faith is not only to believe in something, it is to actually realize the vastness of Buddha's world. You depend on the vastness of the world that embraces and supports your life. And you just bask in it. It's just like the relationship of mother and child, like a baby seeking and basking in mother's compassion. You grow as a child of Buddha. The third mother that I've been thinking about is of our own time and place. And it's the nurturing and healing inner mother. Tim Burkett has given several helpful talks around reparenting ourselves and healing our childhood wounds as a spiritual practice. And Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a book called Reconciliation, Healing the Inner Child. In that book, he says that the cry we hear from deep in our hearts comes from the wounded child within. In each of us, there is a young, suffering child. We have all had times of difficulty as children, and many of us have experienced trauma. If we know how to generate the energy of mindfulness, mindfulness is a strong source of energy that can recognize, embrace and take care of these negative energies. Healing this child's pain is the key to transforming anger, sadness, and fear. The wounded child asks for care and love. Caring for our wounded child arouses compassion and mindfulness in us. And our wounded child may represent several generations. So when we're embracing the wounded child in us, we're embracing all the wounded children of our past generations. That's Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching. I recently read that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, research shows that 61% of adults in the United States experienced at least one ACE, adverse childhood experience, or sometimes it's called event or trauma, when they were growing up. And one in six experienced four or more. And this is many of us. We know that healing this pain is helped by acknowledging and fully understanding what happened, and then treating ourselves with compassion. In my case, an important part of my spiritual path is healing, learning to be the mother that I needed as a child, an inner mother to take care of that sad child, to take that little girl by the hand and say, it's okay, you're safe now, you can relax, I can take care of you. There's something in spiritual practice about restoring our connection to the protection, love, and compassion in the depth of life that mother represents to us. I've been working on this for a long time. So here's a little story from the pandemic when I recognized a change in myself. And it happened because what I wore during the pandemic changed. I did not have a warm relationship with my mother. I believe that she loved me, yet she was emotionally and physically abusive to me in a way that was sort of acceptable at the time, but left emotional scars. I don't have any memories of her hugging me or showing delight in me or giving affection to me the way that she did to her beloved dogs. My mother died 25 years ago. And many years before that, she knit fabulous wool sweaters for me. I still have two of them. On one of them, something went very wrong when she attached the sleeves. So the sweater makes my shoulders look very lumpy, misshapen, just wrong. And so I never wore it. At least not. No, I never wore it. It was in storage. I tried to wear it, but then put it back. But being isolated alone over the winter, one cold day, I thought, well, there's no one here to judge how I look in this sweater, so let's just wear it. And then I ended up wearing it often, even seeking it out, because something happened when I picked it up and put it on. Through touching it and wearing this imperfect sweater, I started having a warm feeling for my mother that I had never had before. I felt grateful for having had a mother who wanted to make things for me, even though she was imperfect and didn't get it right. The sweater became a conduit for feeling connected to her that bypassed our troubled history. I felt how she also had been a wounded child, and she needed mothering too. So I offered it back to her through the sweater, through physically touching the sweater. For me, having this experience of connecting with my mother on a deeper level is an incredible relief. And it feels like the fruit of spiritual practice. Sometimes when I'm working on a talk, things pop up that just seem to belong there in the talk, even though it's not clear to me why. This time, it was a Facebook posting by Kate DiCamillo. DiCamillo is a beloved, best-selling, and award-winning children's book author who happens to live in Minneapolis, not far from Zen Center, as I understand it. She keeps the place private. The Loft Literary Center says her book's themes of hope and belief amid impossible circumstances and their messages of shared humanity and connectedness have resonated with readers of all ages around the world. So here's what DiCamillo wrote on Facebook on April 28th. She says, I was thinking the other day of a Facebook post I did a few years ago about autographing a young boy's book. The kid was leaning up against me as I signed. His mother said, "Stop leaning on her." And the boy looked up at his mother and said, "It's okay, Mom. She knows me." I was so moved. This is still DiCamillo's voice. I was so moved by the notion that we knew each other because of the stories I had written, the stories he had read. Looking back on it now, after a year of no signings, no physical contact, I can still feel that connection. I can feel those readers leaning in. I want them to know I'm leaning back. We're leaning on each other with story. For me, as a mother and a grandmother, feeling a child leaning against me and trusting me to be there for them is one of the great joys of life. And so is leaning together with others through sharing our stories. And that's one of the reasons that I am very happy to be with you today, celebrate Mother's Day with you. And may you all be well. Thank you so much.